When you walk through the garden.
Welcome to a special series of podcasts by the Center for Emerging Media. On Sunday, The Wire will air its final episode, marking the end of five seasons of intense social and political commentary transmitted in the form of a groundbreaking TV drama set right here in our own city, Baltimore. I spoke with the show's creator, David Simon, who also serves as a writer and producer on the series, to hear his thoughts on what The Wire has meant to him and what he thinks it says to all of us about America in the 21st century. Here's our conversation. The conversation I had with Ed was really good. We were talking a lot about just the philosophy behind it. And it's funny, I said to him about whose characters were whose and how you work together to write things. And he said that McNulty was probably more you than him.
No, I say it's more Ed than me. I do. You know, listen, there's some of me in there, and there's some of Ed in there, and there's some of nobody. You know?
Right.
I mean, and there's some of Dominic West. So ultimately, but I think plausible deniability requires Ed to say it's more of me, and it requires me to say it's more of Ed.
But yeah, we were talking about how the characters in this, and it's that those who stand up against the system, those who have some sense of honor and righteousness, no matter who and what they do, are the ones that always seem to get it in the end or get hurt in the process, not be able to come out on top.
Yep.
I mean, I'm always, you know, people always kind of criticize you because not everybody, but some critics will say that, you know, what's his name? Salam wrote that piece where he said David Simon thinks he's constructed a critique of capitalism, but in fact he's prepared an elaborate moving brief for despair and ultimately indifference.
Yeah, I saw that.
What'd you think?
Well, I mean, I would quote Camus back to him, which Camus said, I think, in Myth of Sisyphus, that to rebel against a injustice, against overwhelming odds, is perhaps absurd and futile. But to not rebel is equally absurd and futile. But only one act has the slightest chance of resulting in any human dignity. I'm not quoting him exactly.
No. Yeah, I understand.
I don't have the capacity to quote people exactly without a notepad in front of me.
Me either.
But you know that or the Kafka quote that is read to Bubbles. By his AA sponsor in this season, is where I think The Wire places its humanity. And, I think there's a lot of people trying to tilt at windmills all through the world in various ways, and I think their efforts are the only possibility for human dignity. And I think that's where The Wire is actually a very affectionate and a very sentimental, I don't want to say sentimental. It's a very affectionate piece, and there is some sentiment in
mm-hmm.
The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the human level, and it is arguing for a certain degree of dignity on the part of individuals. But it is a show that is modeled on the Greek tragedies. I mean, you might as well ask me why Antigone or Medea or Oedipus have to go through such hell.
Right.
I mean, it really is modeled on the Greek dramatic tradition and not on sort of the Shakespearean. So given that was our intent, of course we're writing a tragedy. And we're writing a tragedy that is, we hope, reflective of postmodern America.
Let me ask you two questions there that really fascinated me from what you just said. When you talk about the role of drama and the role of a writer and how you view the world, and you just made a really interesting distinction about looking at America in the 21st century, either through Shakespearean lens or classical Greek lens.
Right.
Talk a bit about that in terms of what you define.
I think most of our drama is rooted in the Shakespearean. It's the internal tumult of the individual, of. You know, sometimes almost in the most Freudian possible ways, you look at, you know, I'm talking about some excellent drama here. I'm not trying to pick a fight because I am an admirer of The Sopranos or of Deadwood, for example. But you know, The Life and Times of Tony Soprano or Al Swearingen on those other two shows, it bears more of a resemblance to a Macbeth or a Richard III or a Hamlet. You know, to act or not to act, you know, how do they see themselves? You know, it's the journey into the self that propels the Sopranos forward dramatically. Perfectly valid, not arguing for one way or the other. But what you don't see a lot of in modern American drama, certainly not in television, is the Greek tradition, which was much more a notion of fated individuals, of people put in conflict with inexorable gods and indifferent gods. And you don't see a lot of that. And I think one of the reasons is that our sort of, you know, our Western culture, particularly in the modern sense, I don't think even we give our due to, you know, to Yahweh. I mean, you know, unless you're a fundamentalist, we're not, we don't like the notion that we are not in manifest control of our lives and that we don't choose our beginnings, our middle, and ends. That's, it's almost a fundamental myth of capitalism and of democracy, that the individual controls his outcome. And, you know, and I think a lot of what we go through in modern life is trying to argue against and defeat the randomness of modern life and of inequality and injustice and even death. And so the idea that you are fated or doomed, or that, you know, by exercising free will in the truest sense you are going to be martyred, which was, you know, sort of the very essence of Sophocles and Euripides and all them other fellas, that really bothers us. And mm-hmm. it doesn't have as many adherents. You know, you see an awful lot of Shakespeare done. You see an awful lot of O'Neill done on the stage. You see an awful lot of Ibsen. You don't see a lot of Greek plays done every now and then. But I think it really speaks to the world of The Wire in a way that makes The Wire unique, and it's why we leaned hard on it and we stole big. You know, Cagney said, never steal anything small. Steal
right.
So we did.
But the characters that you've developed that came out of The Wire. I mean, one of the things they do, though, is to, they may not control the beginning, middle, end, and the randomness of existence and the power of the corporate world and the capitalist world that comes at them and surrounds us all, but they are controlling their responses to it.
Absolutely. And therein lies the dignity. And therein lies the heroism, sometimes, depending on the character and depending on the moment. And therein lies the humanity. And it's for that reason that we, our hearts break for them. And, you know, I think in one way that is an improvement upon some of the original plays that we were ripping off, because, you know, the Greeks were, those playwrights were adept at writing about man in an unforgiving world, trying to maintain dignity. But the interior psyche of the characters, that I think that truly did elude them at that point. It certainly was eluding playwrights in the Western canon at that point. That really was for Shakespeare to invent. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I mean, in some ways, you know, somebody writing drama today, you know, pick from one, pick from the other, you know, do what you want with it. But it's the humanity and the wit and the humor of the characters. You know, without the humor, I mean, The Wire to me is one of the funniest shows.
Yeah.
You know, about the decline of the American Empire that's ever been written. And you may quote me.
You know, will.
I mean, you know, I'm not going to say it's one of the funniest shows on TV, but if you're going to do one about the decline of the American Empire, it's pretty damn funny. You know, and you know, without the humor, it's unbearable. Without the wit and the humor and the and the humanity, it would be unbearable.
What did you think of Barack Obama in his love for The Wire saying his favorite character was Omar?
I thought it was a crass appeal for my vote.
Did he get it? Did he
it
get
it? It may have worked. It may have worked. I don't quite know yet. But I mean, in the primary, the privacy and sanctity of the vote in America is sacred. I'm going to vote. But, you know, as far as the general election, you know, McCain's going to have to come out with a very heartfelt love of bunk to counter what Obama has offered me.
McCain and bunk. That's interesting. You know, I have to think that one through.
I don't know if the guy has it in him.
I don't know either. I'm not quite sure.
But we'll see.
But, you know, Omar, though, he loved Omar. And it's interesting that a lot of people don't get all the time this idea that Omar doesn't kill civilians.
He doesn't. You know, he's in the game. He will kill. He is a murderer. But he has one personal distinction, which is, you know, if you're in the game, you're in the game. And if you're not, it's what the mafia used to have, supposedly had in its heyday. What was it, that great line from, it wasn't Luciano, it was Frank Costello, once said to a reporter, relax, we only kill each other. that code doesn't originate with Omar, but he actually practiced it, I thought, quite beautifully.
And you created this character, Omar. I'd like to find out, I'm curious about the creation of this character. Here you have a black, gay, bad man. From the streets. I mean, the cumulative part of this human being portrayed on the screen is, I mean, it's unique. Whoever would have thought
of that. Credit Michael Williams with a lot of it. I mean, you know, he really did bring it. It's always been said that, you know, we didn't plan the character to go along that way, and he only had 7 episodes. And actually, I don't know where that came from. I mean, I know that we told Michael of the 12 or 13 episodes of season 1, I guess it was 13, he was only signed up for 7 of them. Mm-hmm. And that's what we told him. You know, you're only going to be working 7. And we don't know if we have a pickup for season 2, but if we did have season 2, we expected the character to go on. But I think you only have 7. I think I was telling him you only have 7 of the 13, and he came to the conclusion that he had 7, and he better act his ass off. And he did, but you know, I mean, we were taking, if the show went forward, Omar was going forward as well. So, but I think he became convinced that he had some planned obsolescence in the character that he overcame. You know, not really true. I mean, we had a lot of great actors, and we killed some of them,
yes.
And we let some of them live, and it was totally dependent on story.
And the Omar bunk relationship was fascinating to me too. These two men.
Yeah, I love that, and that I got to credit George Pelicanus with developing in the most fundamental way. He wrote that scene on the bench between Bunk and Omar.
That should be one of the great dialogue scenes for acting students anywhere.
I thought what he did with that scene and how he spoke to, you know, Omar's ultimate place. You know that you know it grounded Omar in the original sin of his life, and of what he was doing, and it made sure that you understood that any love you felt for Omar for the way he carried his business had to be equivocal. And to have Bunk do it, and do it on such a personal level, I thought was just brilliant. And, you know, that's George, man. He brings it.
You and George Pelicanus met where?
We met at the funeral of the lady who ran the Mystery Loves Company bookstore in Fells Point.
Oh yeah, I remember that bookstore. Yes,
great, right. Great fan of Paige Rose is a great fan of George's and his work. And she was a big supporter of the book Homicide and a fan of that show. And so we both knew her. And when she passed, we were both at the funeral over in East Baltimore. And and he gave me a lift to the Shiva afterwards. And we talked in the car. I said, listen, I got this show up. It's going to get a full run of at least one season. I'm thinking, of, you know, it should be more like a novel than a television show. And I had read some of George's stuff by this time. I'd been turned on to him, and you know, I mean, Laura, you know, my wife, also
right.
A mystery writer, had been saying you got to read Pelicanus, and I was resistant in that Baltimore way. You know, he's from Washington, really?
Mm-hmm.
He's going to tell me about crime? You know, back up off me, you know. But you know, I finally cracked Sweet Forever. That was the first book of his I read, and so by the time. That funeral happened, and I encountered him again. You know, I tried to recruit him as best I could, and he agreed to do, you know, an episode and start working on the show. So
he's an incredible writer, obviously. I mean, the stuff he came
Absolutely.
Up with, I just
and the other guys too, Lehane and Price, and you know, I mean, it really was a murderer's row after a while.
And Zorzi?
As Zorzi, as the, an elemental part of the writing staff, just because of his sheer knowledge of politics and of the Maryland culture of politics. And, you know, we had Raphael when we did the port story.
Right.
He was invaluable that year.
Raphael Alvarez, yeah.
And nobody's more essential to this than Ed Burns in terms of plotting and you know, I mean, Ed's influential in every part of the story, you know, obviously. But, you know, what he did in season four with his take on the school system was, you know, couldn't have been done without his 7 years of teaching.
Right.
It really was a writing staff tailored to what we were trying to do. And I don't expect to have it that easy ever again.
So I'm curious about, and I think many people will be curious about your relationship with Ed Burns and where it began. And how you two, I think in many ways, as Ed had told me, your relationship has really deeply affected one another and you're looking the way you look at life.
I think so. I mean, I've learned a lot from Ed. Ed's one of the smartest people I know.
Yep.
I'm one of the most genuine. Mm-hmm. He is an unlikely compadre for projects like The Wire or The Corner by the resume. You know, when I encountered him, he was a police detective. And, you know, some of those guys are very, very smart. I don't mean to suggest that. But, you know, the notion of being adept at narrative and at storytelling and at parable, and that's a lot less likely. You know, I mean, there's a joke that inside every police officer, there's a book.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably where it should stay. but Ed, you know, I met Ed when I was researching a series of articles on Melvin, little Melvin Williams. And Ed was the arresting officer. It was a wiretap case, went back to 84. And I met him and his partner, Harry Edgerton, in the DEA offices. And I had a sort of a pro forma interview. It was my first interview on the project. And it occurred to me that everybody was being really polite. They were being helpful, but it was very polite. And the surroundings weren't helping, you know, up in the Fallon building.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked Ed if I could meet him, you know, outside of work. And I'm thinking, my usual cop reporter self, I'm thinking, yeah, you know, some bar somewhere. You know, I buy the beers.
Right.
Except, you know, I don't think Ed had been, I don't think Ed had been killing bars since his time in the Western District, you know. There's some stories about Ed back in the day, but, I think he'd settled down. So he asked me to meet him at the Towson Library Branch. So right away I knew it was really furtive, you know, this was some real CIA stuff we were involved in. And I got there and I met him and he was ready to check out and he had this stack of books. And I remember some of them. And, you know, one of them was a series of essays by Hannah Arendt, you know, Banality of Evil and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Foles, the Magus, and Bob Woodward's Veil and about two or three others. And it was such an eclectic reading list that I looked at him and I said, "You're not really a cop, are you?" And he just gave this little weird smile, and then we started talking about everything that was wrong with the police department and the drug war, and, you know, not only about the Melvin Williams case, but he became, I think it's fair to say now that we're both out of it, and I can say this, I would have never said it, obviously, if either one of us was in the game. He was a great source. And a very accurate source. He did not, you know, he had a lot of axes to grind, but he never ground one unfairly that I could tell. And he also became sort of a guidance counselor in terms of my reporting. I mean, I remember when I was getting ready to do a homicide, and he was actually in the FBI doing the Bordley case, so mm-hmm. He was not in the homicide unit then. But they were letting me in the unit, and the one thing he told me, he said, you know, there's some good guys up there, there's some guys who, who weren't very much good at all, but the one guy you have to follow, the one guy you have to pay attention to, is Donald Warden.
Yes.
And I said, what's with Donald? Because I don't know if you've met Donald.
Yes.
You know, he's this gap-toothed polar bear-looking guy who doesn't look like he's got as much on the ball as some of the others. Truth is, he's unbelievable as a detective. And Ed said, don't sleep on Donald Warden. You know, this guy's natural police. That's the mm-hmm. first time I heard that line. And, you know, and he was right. Donald was an essential part of the book. So, you know, from a very early point in our relationship, I began to trust him. And when it came time for him to retire, I asked him if he wanted to do The Corner. And, you know, that was 16 years ago. So we're off and running.
You just finished the other film together as well, right? The one that you did in Namibia.
We did a 7-part series on the Iraq War based on a book, Generation Kill, by Evan Wright. I think it's the best war reporting, certainly the best narrative war reporting out of Iraq yet. I would compare it to Michael Herr's Dispatches. I think it's that good. I don't think that's hyperbole.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote the scripts with Evan and with Ed Burns, who, of course, is a Vietnam vet and, you know, is, I thought, you know, brought something very special and some real special perspective to the project. And Ed was actually the guy who went over to Africa for the full 6 months. I was there at the beginning and at prep and at the end, but Ed was the guy who really shepherded that thing in terms of the writer-producer.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing it in conjunction with a British producing crew as well, who've been wonderful to work with.
So I can't wait to see the final episode of this and kind of reflect on that. I mean, it's just many people have said that The Wire is going to end up being one of these pieces that is studied in colleges 20 years from now, and you want to look at what urban America was like in the end of the 20th, beginning of the 21st century.
Hopefully it won't be looked upon for its nostalgia. Hopefully some stuff's going to get better, you know?
Did you think so? I mean, how does that live within
you? I don't. I am, you know, politically I'm a pessimist at this point.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe we can actually even recognize our fundamental problems, much less begin to address them. And that is what the last season of The Wire was about. So, no, I don't think it's going to get better. But having said that, I live in Baltimore, and I also, you know, happen to be an American. And, you know, I'm with everyone else just waiting around to see the game on Saturdays and, you know, and trying to figure out where you can get a good meal and you know, looking at the price of gas at the tank. And, Jesus, you know, I'd love The Wire to be wrong about everything.
Yeah. But
you know, I'm not, this is not a gleeful pessimism. It's a worried pessimism. And, you know, if The Wire is wrong, nobody will be happier than me.
Well, you know, Ed, I guess it was about a year and a half ago, Ed Burns and I were on a panel together down at the University of Maryland, and he really pissed off a lot of people.
Really?
No,
Ed?
No, not Ed. How could that happen?
I am shocked.
He said, I was tired of hearing about saving one body at a time. It's all a waste of time. I don't want to be involved in anything unless it has to do with thorough systemic change. And
I know where he's coming from.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, everyone's trying to play with the fine-tuning knobs in all of these institutions. As, you know, as if they get the treble and the bass and the balance just right, things will start to work. You know, and the back of the machine is on fire. And nobody can actually see it because everybody is either, you know, co-opted within the institution, or we're engaged in a political dynamic that's sort of an either or with a limited range of choice. And you know, Ed, in addition to being a storyteller and working on The Wire and working on these other projects, Ed has spent a lot of time trying to get like nonprofits in Baltimore and school system and various institutions to try some things that he believes in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, try some programming that he believes in. And it is, you know, talk about a Greek tragedy. You know, it's that fella on the rock in the hill. You know, and so I understand Ed's frustration.
And he hasn't given up on that either. But one of the other things that really fascinates me is I think the challenges of viewer psyche, the American psyche watching The Wire, is the question of honor and humanity and the levels on which it's found and where it's not, and how it crosses all planes from this, the corner to police officers, whoever else you're portraying. And that's something that really challenges kind of our notion of what honor, honesty, and humanity mean.
Right. I'm not interested in, like, labels of good and evil. Like, this guy's a drug dealer, so he's evil. Or this guy's a cop, so he's good. Or this guy's a politician, so he's either good or evil. He's either a good guy or a former or a bad guy, a guy who needs to be thrown out of office. You know, that whole dynamic is, this probably is hyperbole, but I'm going to go for it anyway. That's the pornography of American entertainment. that's, you know, that is every cop show and every lawyer show and, you know, every single drama that is offered up for popular entertainment is on some level a political or cultural form of pornography. And I'm tired of it. And, mm-hmm. you know, it bores the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not to say that there aren't moments where it's done so well that, you know, I want to stand up and cheer now and then, you know, it's like, give me Atticus Finch and Gregory Peck and yeah, you know, I'm in for a pound along with everybody else, but it's done so badly so often that there's nothing there anymore. It's been almost eviscerated. You know, we were just after something else. We were trying to look at systems and systemic failure. We were depicting an America that has become a can't-do country. We can't resolve.
Right.
You know, we can't get the intelligence right on Iraq. We can't figure out what these guys are doing in flight schools all over the country. You know, we can't tell ourselves the truth about No Child Left Behind and look behind the stats. You know, we can't tell ourselves that our police department is making up stats so a guy can be elected governor. You know, it's like whatever the task is, you know, we will somehow find a way not to do it. That, to me, is America at the millennium. I'm sorry to say. I no longer believe that we are the can-do harbinger of the world's last best hope.
When people say that, and people have argued that, and Mark Bowden did in his article, but other people as well, that you miss a layer of the black world, you miss the beauty and the love that goes on inside inner city streets, or what people call the quote unquote good souls who fight against the corner. Is that a fair critique?
Well, you know, Mark said a lot of things. I apparently am the angriest man in television. Which, as a matter of, I take that as a vague matter of praise, but I think it's rather faint. The second angriest man in television, I believe, is by a kidney-shaped pool with his cell phone in Bel Air somewhere, and he's screaming because he doesn't have enough points on the DVDs. You know, I hate to tell you what the third angriest man in television is doing. He's probably asleep. So, you know, there was a little bit of personal hyperbole in that piece that I didn't quite know what to do with. I mean, Mark is very good friends with a couple of editors that, you know, I hold me in low regard and I hold in low regard, and I've made no bones about it for mm-hmm. about a decade. And I recently found out he blurbed the book of the fabricator that I had a hand in outing at the Baltimore Sun. So there's something very loyal and personal to this thing for Mark, and I sort of admire that in a way. I got to tell you, loyalty is something I do admire.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it colors, in a sense, his view of what The Wire is and isn't. The first thing is, it's fiction, and people who write fiction get to make choices. And if I decide that the premise is going to be the interior of the drug trade, and the interior of the police department, the second season is going to be the interior of the unionized America at the port, and the third season is going to be the interior of the political structure. The home life, or the ordinary lives of ordinary people who are not engaged in those endeavors, are certainly going to be peripheral. That's a storytelling choice. You know, any story cannot be everything. It has to be something. And that's a fundamental of any form of narrative storytelling. Now, having said that, wherever we had the opportunity to depict viable working class and middle class people, be it the Colvins at home, you know, adopting Namat, or the teachers who were working in the school system and trying to do good work, or the deacon representing, mm-hmm. I think, the best aspects of the black church in a place like Baltimore,
mm-hmm.
Or in a variety, and I could go on and give you about 12, 15, 20 different characterizations that had nothing to do with anything other than moving through their day trying to make their lives better and trying not to do any harm and being regular folk, I would say that they are represented in the piece. Are they the center of the piece? Nope. And nor do I think they have to be for the piece to be valid. And so I'm not sure.
But they're essential to the piece, don't you think?
Yeah. They are. I think they're essential. parts of the frame in which the picture is perceived. And ultimately, I mean, I think the question becomes, what are you trying to say, and what are the tools you need to say it? And, you know, one of the fundamental things we were trying to say is that the drug war is a disaster, and it needs to be ended. And that was unequivocal, and it was, if The Wire comes out of this with one fundamental and practical political message, that would be it. And, you know, I'm not sure that anything other than depicting the drug war gets you there. You know, obviously, it's a lovely thought that you're going to also include every other aspect of African American life in The Wire. But I don't think The Wire ever claimed or ever intended itself to be a chronicle of African American life in America. That is too broad a statement to be covered by any show, anywhere. And I certainly wouldn't attempt that. And one of the fundamental flaws that a new critic always makes when they're not used to endeavoring in criticism, I think, is to criticize or to critique the show that they to seek the show that they wanted to see, rather than the show that's mm-hmm. there, or the book they wanted to read, rather than the one that's there, or whatever. And so I kind of know how to ruminate on somebody who has an interesting critique of what is on the screen. But somebody who wants to see a different story entirely, it's, well, you know, more power to you. Go make it. Go write it.
And finally here, David, a non-Wire question. What are you doing now? What are you into now besides the work you're finishing? What are you reading and thinking about at the moment?
I just read Richard Price's new book, Lush Life, which is set on the Lower East Side of New York, and it is a police procedural, but it's one with ghosts. I mean, it's just beautiful.
Uh-huh.
It's really about America and post 9/11 America in that sense, and I think it's just magnificent. And I would love to get a chance to make that, and I'm talking to Richard about it, and I hope we get it together. I'm finishing a pilot on New Orleans post-Katrina about musicians, again.
I heard about this. This is a dramatic piece, right?
Right, and this has nothing to do with, yeah, it's a continuing series for HBO. I hope they greenlight it. It obviously is not about crime or drugs, so maybe that's an answer to the previous question, is that, you know, there are lots of different stories, and you know, there's lots of reasons to tell different stories, and you'll get no argument from me. Also, I think Ed is now engaged in starting to beat out the story of Donnie and Fran. You know, the prototype Omar and our protagonist from the corner who found each other and have married. And I think basically should be they are the prom king and queen of Baltimore, or they should be. I love Fran to death, and I love Donnie, and it really is a remarkable story of redemption, and it has an honest to God earned happy ending. I don't know what we'll do with that. I don't know. You know,
it's a good thing though.
We'll mess it up, you know, probably. but Ed's starting to work on that. That has sold as a film to a film company, and we're trying to write that now. So I mean, I'm making more movies if I can. And,
that's great, man.
Oh, and I don't have enough. Zorzi, Bill Zorzi, and myself are working on a book about Pennsylvania Avenue and the rise of drugs in sort of Baltimore in terms of, you know, the creation of the drug culture in American life. Sort of Pennsylvania Avenue from like the 50s to the 70s. Because a lot of those guys are dying out.
Yes, they are.
And we are trying to get to the ones who are still around and get their stories and get it down on paper before it's gone.
Well, I don't think you're doing enough, David. You should do some more.
Absolutely. I'm not working hard enough.
Thanks a lot, man.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. So. I got to tell you this, too. I know it didn't come up in the interview, but this is the part that I'm totally loving this year, which is everyone's paying attention to the fabricating reporter, because that's the overt outrage in the story. But the real critique of the media that's in this season of The Wire is that, with the exception of a very good act of journalism on either end, you know, in the beginning episode, they dig the stuff out of the city council meeting, and they do a good piece of adversarial journalism.
Right.
And at the end, the Fletcher character writes a beautiful narrative piece about bubbles, and that, you know, between those bookends, the Baltimore Sun depicted misses every single story. Like, you know what's going on in the world. You know they're cooking the stats. You know that No Child Left Behind third grade test scores are bullshit. You know how the Clay Davis prosecution was undercut. Like, the viewer knows everything, and they see just where the disconnect is with the eviscerated, you know, half-gutted newspaper missing the real dynamic of the city, episode by episode, down to, you know, not knowing who Prop Joe is and running it as a brief. And,
right, right.
You know, that's the total theme. And here's the great moment of meta. I am the king of meta, is that with the exception of one or two guys who've been watching closely, the people who are, like, freaking out about the season are the journalists. Not necessarily the TV critics. They're just watching it as TV. But, like, the journalists are just freaking out and, you know, angry and petulant. And they sound like a herd of cats in the alley. And not one of them is referencing that. And if you think about it, it's so beautifully meta. You know, it's all across the country, newspapers that have been killed by out-of-town ownership are missing, are no longer covering their city in a viable way.
Right.
That's depicted, and nobody notices that it's depicted.
But it's so obvious. And I mean, it's not just, see, even in the middle, when you talk about, because most of the characters in the newsroom are honorable newsmen trying to do a job.
Absolutely. But between the economic preamble of the internet and the cutbacks and everything, and the fact that, you know, the ambitions are so stunted and small trick, you know, in terms of the Pulitzers and you know, prize journalism, and when you look at, like, what they're capable of in terms of sustained journalism, that's the depicted tragedy. And nobody will talk. It's like, it's not that they're not arguing about it. They don't even see it, which is, again, I feel like the king of meta. If they don't see it because they don't actually see it in the newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
If they did, they'd be freaking out, saying, we don't cover our cities anymore. That's why people have turned away. And so I'm fascinated by the fact, you know, I figured I'd pick an argument, and they'd argue over that depiction. They don't even notice it.
That's amazing.
It's a season about, you know, we can't even recognize our own problems, and the institution that's supposed to recognize problems can't even recognize its own. They're arguing about whether the fabricator is a fair portrayal and whether the editors would, you know. It's like, yeah, I know, guys, that's the easy part. Look at what the newspaper, look at how the newspaper connects or doesn't connect to the city.
Right.
The only guy who got it was a guy, Brian Lowry, who writes for Variety.
Mm-hmm.
He used to be at the LA Times, and now he's at Variety. And I think it's the distance of walking away from a newspaper and standing a few steps away. He got it instantly. Everybody else is arguing about, you know, this guy. It's just, they're arguing about character. They're arguing about this scene or that scene. Why would you know, Zerwick is about, you know, whether the cameos of Olesker, you know, he's like, you know, a little something about forest and trees, you know? I mean, they're arguing about whether or not Alma would have driven down to, why didn't she just look at her front page byline on the website? You know, I'm like,
And there's, I mean, those are just such minor details. Actually, Dave and I talked about that on the air together.
Oh, I never heard it.
Yeah, because I thought that everyone kind of missed it. He and I really did disagree about the analysis of what that was about.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's amazing how forest and trees this thing is. I feel like I'm the king of meta. I really do. I'm loving it. It's like, it's just beautiful.
Well, you should.
And you know, I'm really having a fun time with it. It's making me giggle.
Well, it's good to see you giggle, man. You got to giggle sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, bro.
All right, be well, man.
Tammy, you too, man. Take it soon. You're listening to a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're engineered today by Andrew Epic. Thanks to Clean Cuts Music and Sound for studio space. And you can visit us at marksteinerblog.wordpress.com or Google Mark Steiner Blog. And I'm Mark Steiner for the Center for Immersion Media. Take care.